Welcome to Missing. I am Tim, here today with Lance. Lance, how are you today?
I'm doing very well, Tim. Thank you for asking. I hope everyone out there is doing well. How are you?
I am doing great on this Monday morning. And Lance, this is an episode that we aired on Crawlspace a couple of weeks ago. We got such good feedback from it, we decided to release it here on Missing as well. This one, we're speaking with author Maureen Boyle, who she's written several true crime books, and this one is called Shallow Graves, The Hunt for the New Bedford Highway Serial Killer. So we're talking about her book about the New Bedford Highway Serial Killer today, which is interesting, I think, to us, Lance, because we're both from this area and have not heard of it until this book.
Exactly. And the book is great. And Maureen does a great job breaking down the 11 women who went missing over the spring and summer of 1988 in New Bedford, Massachusetts. If anyone's familiar with that town, that small city, it is known as the Whaling City. And this is where Moby Dick, Frederick Douglass, and Herman Melville all have had a significant impact in New Bedford.
The book is great. I urge everyone to check it out. I listened to it on Audible. It's a great listen as well. And she's got a new book out called The Ghost, The Murder of Police Chief Greg Adams and the Hunt for His Killer that came out more recently. But get them both. There are links in the show notes.
We guarantee you'll love them. The Crawlspace guarantee.
Thanks a lot for listening, everybody. If you like what you hear, please follow Crawlspace as well. We're going to break for a commercial here, and we'll be right back with Maureen Boyle.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of The Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to The Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into The Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to The Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in The Daily Book Club.
Welcome to the podcast, author Maureen Boyle. How are you today?
Very good, very good. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you for agreeing to do this interview. Just a real quick piece of back information here. A few weekends ago, I wanted to clean the house. I had thought to myself that it's overdue for a good cleanse, and I wanted to listen to a book while I did that. And needless to say, after putting on your book, Shallow Graves, on Audible, I didn't clean the place. I still live in a dirty house because of you. So thank you very much for that.
Thrilled. Anything I can do to keep people from doing housework and that sort of thing.
Well, I did manage to clean, so we're good. We're not living in filth anymore. So you can rest easy on that. But your book is amazing, and we had never heard of this before.
You never heard of the case?
We couldn't believe it. I'm from Massachusetts. I grew up in Medford, and I do a crime podcast, and I'd never heard of the case until your book.
It's incredible. I mean, it's not even like we were too young either. This was 1988, 1989. I mean, it was on the news.
I know. And that's one of the reasons why I did the book, is that there's so many people in Massachusetts who do not know of this case, about the killer and about the victims. And I really think much more attention needs to be paid to this case in particular.
Absolutely. So you mentioned that was one of the reasons that you decided to write the book. What is your background?
I've been a newspaper reporter for more years than I care to admit. You know, I started way back when I was still in high school. I was a newspaper reporter primarily covering cops and crime and courts in New Hampshire and here in Massachusetts, in New Bedford and in Brockton. Back in 88, I was a newspaper reporter at the Standard Times. That's a daily paper in New Bedford. And I was covering this case in 88. So I was really intimately aware of everything that was going, or what I thought was everything that was going on with the case, until I started re-reporting things for this book and discovered there's just so much more about the case that I did not know about. And here we are.
So for those of the listeners who don't know this case, the New Bedford Highway serial killer, you covered it in 1988, and then you recovered it with your book, Shallow Graves. That was 2017, right? That was published?
Yes, came out in 2017. For those who don't know anything about the case, back in 1988, roughly between March and April of 88 to September of 1988, 11 women went missing in New Bedford. The common thread with all of the women was that they were all addicted to drugs. The bodies of 9 of them were eventually found on the highways that surround New Bedford. That would be 195, 140, and 88 going to Horseneck Beach in Westport. None of the bodies, interestingly enough, were found in New Bedford. They're all found just right outside. If you think of a donut, and New Bedford in the center of a donut, and the bodies were found in that circle surrounding New Bedford, the highway circle surrounding them.
Interesting. Yeah, that makes me think of like geo-profiling based on where the bodies were found.
Yeah, a lot's been discussed about like why none of the bodies were found in New Bedford. Why weren't any of the bodies found in the city? Was there a reason for it? Did they not want New Bedford police to investigate the case? Or was the killer more familiar with the suburbs around New Bedford? And, you know, and despite the title of the book, the women were found right off the highway. So imagine if a car pulls over to the side of the road and the killer can just pick up the body and put them right inside the tree line on the highway. So that if you're driving by, you don't see the body, but if you stopped along the highway in order to change a tire or perform some bodily function, that is, you might stumble upon the body. And that's how several of the bodies had been found. Someone just happened to stop along the highway.
So take us back to 1988, your days as a crime reporter. Had you reported on anything that I guess you hadn't, because this was so unique and probably once in a lifetime coverage opportunity for a crime reporter? How did this come to you? And then when did you start putting it together that these were probably connected?
Prior to this, I was doing a lot of stories on heroin addiction. Now, in the 1980s, unlike today, where everyone is very familiar with opiate addiction, there's many more services available for those who are addicted. Back then, there wasn't. There was a real need in New Bedford. And I was doing a number of stories about women who were addicts, women who were on the street who were addicts, the nexus between street prostitution in the city and heroin addiction, and also some of the assaults on women who were on the street. By some of the Johns on the street. So I was very familiar with what was going on at that time, but I never dreamed that there would be an actual serial killer, especially in a city like New Bedford, which is a very, very tight-knit community, people there are very, very hardworking. For those who aren't familiar with the city of New Bedford, it's a large fishing community, very family-oriented. People stay there. It's a very historic and it's a really lovely city.
Yeah, I think you explained it really well when you said people stay there. It has a really incredible history of whaling, and that industry went away. So the town was affected by that. It was impacted by that. But the people there, when you're describing communities and saying like salt of the earth people, like anytime someone says it, I think New Bedford, just like that tight knit, close, warm, welcoming type community.
And it seems like everyone's related to someone by marriage. You know, there it is a city where, you know, my husband sometimes would joke with me, is like, you don't have to talk so softly in restaurants. No one's listening to our conversations. And it's like, yes, they are, because everyone knows everyone and everyone will can hear what you're saying to people, you know, to someone. It's so that is one of the reasons why I was really so shocked at with this case. And why people, the police were so stymied in the search for the killer, because I would have thought that the killer would have been caught immediately.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's sort of what we were getting to there, is that you have this community that people know, you know, everyone knows everyone, and someone got away with doing this in just over the course of a year.
Yes, in under a year. That's what's so frightening. It goes from... Yeah. From you know, roughly March, April to September, and then and the bodies were found between July of 88 going into 1989. And it, I think one of the problems with the case for investigators was that by the time they knew that there was a serial killer in the area, the killer had stopped killing. And as a result of that, it was really difficult to track him. And they also had to go back into time and retrace the steps of the women. And while in a couple of cases, women were reported missing immediately by their family and friends, there were some cases where the victims were either not reported missing at all or reported missing sometime later. So it was really, really hard to say, okay, when was the last time you saw so-and-so? And since none of the women, only basically the women were not employed in 9-to-5 jobs, so you can't say, well, they were last seen at work at such and such time. The timeline was really very, very fluid.
And what was it like back then, back when this occurred? What was the town like? Was it fearful, or was there a bit of a distance there?
It's interesting. There were some people who were very, very fearful. There were some people who felt, oh, no, it doesn't affect me. So there was that split. The families that were affected and the ripple effect of the killings, I think, really did affect a good number of people in the city and the surrounding communities. Those that were more well-to-do in the communities were not affected quite as much. And there were, of course, there was always a couple of people who would say, oh, well, you know, it was only happening to those people, not to the rest of us. Now, keep in mind, this was also a time before heroin addiction, opiate addiction really made the news, made the national news, made state news. So people were thinking, well, that's not going to happen to our family. And as we all know, a heroin addiction can happen and touch any family.
For your book, did you rely on interviews that you had done, or perhaps even tapes of interviews or anything with law enforcement or family members back then?
Back then, in the olden days, we really didn't tape interviews. We would write them out. And I did a lot of stories during that period of time. So I had background to rely on in terms of scenes and things like that. But I did go back and re-interview people, both law enforcement and family members, and then some other records that I was able to obtain to give a little bit more depth to the story. And, you know, keep in mind, I had thought that I knew everything about the case because I was there and covering it. But in the re-reporting for the book, I discovered there was a lot more going on behind the scenes in the investigation than any of us knew publicly.
That is that's what they call a big market tease right there. So well played. How closely back then did you work with law enforcement while you were covering this?
Oh, I was pestering them all the time. It's, you know, they had a job to do, and there were certain things that they would not tell reporters about. And it was my job to find out information that maybe they wouldn't want out or they didn't know about. So, and the role of a reporter is to get information, just like that's the role of law enforcement investigators. It's in some ways, it's the same skill set, So I was interviewing some of the same people that they were interviewing.
It doesn't sound like there was a poor investigation in the case based on, you know, listening to your book. So I'm also a bit surprised why it wasn't solved. What do you think the holdup was?
I think that there were so many suspects in the case. That was one of the key issues. And there was not enough evidence to charge someone for a case to go to trial and to convict someone. There was a lot of speculation on who the killer is. If you ask any person in the area here, they'll go, oh, it's this person. It's that person. Oh, I know who the killer is because so-and-so told me that they heard it from their, you know, cousin down the street that it was, you know, blah, blah, blah. And that's, no, so I'm not saying any names, but they did not have that smoking gun, so to speak, to say, yes, this is who it is. Each of these women were last seen with this individual, and then they were never seen again. And the individual told someone that he killed them. There was none of that. They didn't have a confession. They didn't have witnesses. They didn't have witnesses that put any of their known suspects with the victim on the last known moments of their lives. In other words, they didn't have any evidence.
Which is amazing to me. They didn't have any, I wrote that down, like evidence with a question mark. They didn't have any evidence and they didn't, so therefore they weren't ever able to put together point A to point B. You know, they weren't able to connect anybody, which must have been incredibly frustrating and must have added like an element of sort of dread to the city. I mean, at that time, were these suspects talked about like while the killings were happening?
No, not while they were happening, but, you know, after the killing stopped, when some names began to surface, people were like, oh, I know this person, I know that person. But during the same period of time, people in the public were calling the district attorney's office, state police, to give tips and to say who they may have thought the killer is. And I'll tell you, during that period of time, it was a very bad period of time for soon-to-be ex-husbands, because a lot of angry wives or soon-to-be ex-wives were calling police to say, you know, my ex-husband or my, you know, estranged husband is the highway killer. And this is the reasons why.
And where did you find that information? How did you obtain that information?
Talking to people.
Yeah.
Talking to people. And it's, you just, and you know, what's also interesting is because no one knew who the killer was, people started looking around them themselves and in their neighborhoods and in even in church and say, could this be the killer? Could I be sitting next to him in a pew? Could I be sitting across from him in a restaurant? Is he sitting at the bar? Is he in the store? Is he working with me? Is he a fisherman? Is he a lawyer? Is he a doctor? I mean, there is so many individuals. Is he a cop? There is so many individuals that came under the microscope.
Absolutely. And one of them that you wrote about in your book, Kenneth Pont, is very, I guess, controversial character and seems quite suspicious to me. I know he passed away. What are your feelings on this person?
I'm glad that you brought him up because there was a good reasons for police to be investigating him. Now, there are some people in New Bedford who will tell you that the district attorney's office was scapegoating him, that they had no reason to, they hunted him, they had no reason to be looking at him as a suspect, when they had very good reasons. He knew many of the women who were killed, and that isn't necessarily mean that he was the killer, because in a small community, people travel in very similar circumstances, like people who have a podcast know other people who are, you know, podcasters. Writers know writers, nurses know nurses, teachers know teachers, and drug addicts know other drug addicts. And he was a recovering heroin addict who became a cocaine addict. He relapsed and became and was addicted to cocaine. He was also a lawyer. And he was really trying to keep his addiction hidden. So he knew a lot of the people that were on the street, and he would have some of the women who were on the street get drugs for him and come back to his house, and he would do coke with them. And he was kind of weird. You know, I described some of the situations and his paranoia in the book. So they had very good reason to look very, very closely at him. And he was also not cooperative at all with investigators. And he left the area about a month, month and a half after the last killing. So that was all, you know, red flags with him. And he was a bit of a jerk. That was the other thing. He was just very much a jerk to the cops.
And he was never off their radar, was he?
Never. Never, ever, ever. He was always on the radar. There are some investigators who still say, yes, he was the killer, because he was charged in one of the cases, but the charge was later dropped because there wasn't enough evidence to substantiate it. He was indicted in only one of the cases, and that was for the murder of a woman from the Cape who was originally from Falmouth, and her name was Rochelle D'Apriella. She was staying with him for a period of time. And based on the timeline that investigators were able to put together, they believe that he may have been the last person to see her alive. So that they built a case just on her murder, but not with any of the other ones.
But he had known a couple of the other victims. And also, he phoned the police at one point about a videotape. Can you tell us about this story?
Well, this was before the murders. It was a very weird situation where he was claiming that this was in the age of videotape as opposed to, you know, DVDs or streaming. And he was claiming that the film that was being shown on his TV screen was a snuff film, and it was a comedy. And he was pointing out, I mean, he was hallucinating and pointing out, you know, don't you see that? Don't you see that? Don't you see what they're doing? And the cops thought that was very, very strange. And it stuck in their heads. It really stuck with them.
Right. And there wasn't any murder over, I think it was Porky's, yes, the movie that he had rented.
They took the video, examined it, had it forensically examined to make sure there wasn't any hidden images in there. And it was just a plain regular videotape.
But that's a rumor that persisted in the case, that that there were snuff films made.
What's interesting about that is another state police investigator who said that when he was starting to also look at the snuff films, and he started talking to people and realized that it may not be snuff films. Someone may have been talking about, and this is where Southeastern Mass accents come in, they were talking about smut films as opposed to snuff films. They were looking at the production of pornographic films made locally and to see if any of the women who were found dead, if they were in any of them. And they were not able to find any evidence of that.
Just talk about like a gross element to it. I mean, it's a tragic story in itself, but you just add that layer of that element, and it just gets like real dark.
Yes, yes. Everything that happened in 1988 with the murders of these young women, it really is very, very dark, and it is very, very tragic all around. Especially when you realize that of the 11 who went missing, 9 of them had children.
So tragic.
Yeah, awful. So 2 of them are still unaccounted for.
2 of the victims are still unaccounted for. And what's interesting about these two cases is both women were tied to law enforcement somehow. One, her mother was engaged to a Dartmouth police officer. And in the second case, the second woman, her father was a retired New Bedford cop. And that's why when people who are not familiar with the case will say, oh, if these women were the, you know, daughters or sisters of cops, you know, they would have found the killer. And this is a prime example that you have two cases where, yes, the victims were relatives of members of law enforcement, and you know that they wanted to find, number one, find those two remains and find the killer. And there was a lot of discussion on why these two women remain missing. Is it because the killer hid them so well because of their ties to law enforcement? Or is it simply that no one found that exact spot where they are? I think that they haven't found exactly where they are. Because if you drive along the highway sometime and you just look from side to side, there could be bodies over there and you don't know it.
Oh my God. As a crime podcaster, I think about that as I drive on the highway. I do. I can't help it.
Oh my God, me too.
I mean, even on the ramps in some of the smaller communities, you know, we're not talking about Boston, but, you know, get outside of the city. A lot of the ramping systems, you know, there's woods, there's trees. Who goes in there? You never know what could be in there.
And these cases are all believed to be met by the same killer.
Yes. Yeah, they do believe that it is the same person. Number one, because of the victimology, where the women were found, how they were found. It does appear that they're all tied together. They were all believed to have been strangled, even though the cause of death was only determined in two of the cases, positively in two of the cases.
And was there ever any indication of what they were strangled with? Articles of clothing or?
Yeah, in two of the cases, it is where they were able to determine cause of death, it was articles of clothing. In the other cases, because of the condition of the bodies, they weren't able to determine how they were strangled.
Very chilling.
Yeah.
And I know that John Douglas and the FBI's behavioral analysis unit got involved, I think, for a short period. Do you know if that was helpful at all?
It was, but I think the state police were hoping, and remember, this was very early on, they were hoping that somehow this would be the magic bullet for them, that the unit would be able to tell them, you know, this is exactly what you're looking for. And they can't do that. They can give you some broader parameters. But, you know, they were hoping for more than they had.
Have you looked into other killings that might have happened prior or, you know, before or after this string of homicides happened? And this was like every month. And sometimes two or three times a month for the New Bedford Highway serial killer. Is that pattern evident in any other serial killings that you've maybe looked into?
I looked at a case in New York that was around that same time with Shawcross. They ruled him out. There's some serial killings in Connecticut. I know that they looked into that to see if that was in tied to it at all, as well as the killings in New Hampshire. They were looking at any and everything across the country, and there did not seem to be direct ties to it. That doesn't mean that there aren't, but they could not find any ties to other cases.
What about the Lisbon Ripper?
That is a different type of, they did look into that. That was a different type of murder. And not quite the same as the New Bedford cases.
Yeah. And the reason why I bring that up, because it just sounded like it was very out of the blue right there on my part, is that happened in Lisbon, Portugal. And the detectives from Portugal visited New Bedford to perhaps see a connection or to get, you know, maybe some sort of professional advice. I just thought that was fascinating.
And one of the reasons why is because there are so many people from New Bedford who are from Portugal or have families there. And there is a lot of travel between the two countries, between the city and Portugal. So that was something that could not be ignored.
Interesting. And so many good local suspects, though. Can you tell us about Tony DiGrazio?
Yep. He was a young man from Freetown who he came to light through the investigation. He had two previous charges of rape. Both of them he was found not guilty. One of them involved two teenage girls that were hitchhiking, or he offered to give them a ride. And they said he was sexually assaulted them. And he was later found not guilty in Fall River District Court. He had a history of, at least according to some women who were working the streets, of picking up prostitutes and raping them or beating them. And he was eventually charged in those in a string of cases as part of this investigation. He was looked at by some as a very good suspect in the case. But again, there wasn't anything that was a smoking gun in the case to charge him in the murders. But he did have a string of sexual assault cases.
And he's no longer with us as well, right?
No, he has since passed. He's dead.
And speaking of that, how did Kenneth Pont die?
Kenneth Pont is a very, depending on your viewpoint, it's a very sad end to him. He's continued to spiral out of control, and he died alone in his house, natural causes. He continued to use coke. He was found in the room, like the living room, where he had a bed in his living room. He was had been there for a number of days. It was not a pretty sight. So he died alone in his house, in a maggot-filled house at that point. It was gross. It was trash everywhere. It was filthy. It wasn't good. So this is a man who, you know, actually he was the poster child originally for drug recovery. When he was a heroin addict, he got arrested for possession. He got help, went to college, then later got his law degree, got his record expunged so he could become a lawyer. I mean, he wasn't a top lawyer in the city, but he was an attorney and had his own cases in district court and civil court. And, you know, he was mildly successful. And then drugs grabbed him again, and his life completely spiraled out of control after the charges against him were eventually dropped. Some would argue his life was spiraling out of control even before.
And right before his death, or not right before his death, but within a year or so, his old residence was dug up by police?
Yes. So there had been a persistent rumor that, during 1988, he got a new cement deck in his backyard. And there was a persistent rumor that one of the missing women, Christina Montero, was buried underneath that deck. Years later, the district attorney in Bristol County was able to convince the bank, which at that point owned the property, to allow them to go there and dig up that cement deck. And they did, and they didn't find any human remains.
Now, I know one rumor that seems pretty common in unsolved cases is Satanists or a group of Satanists. Did you ever find any truth to those rumors or anything substantiated?
No. There was no satanic cult involved in this case. It involved drugs, but no Satanism, no dancing in the Freetown State Forests, conjuring up demons. None of that was involved in this.
Well, that's a relief.
Yes, but I still will not go into the Freetown State Forest alone.
The very sage advice right
yes.
there. And we'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors.
Step into the hidden corridors of the past with Hometown History, where every episode uncovers the untold stories and secrets nestled in the streets and alleys of our own backyards. We bring history to life, revealing the extraordinary in the ordinary, from local legends to forgotten tales that shape the communities we know today. Tune in to Hometown History and embark on a journey through time, right from where you are. Gather round, friend, and join me by the fire. I have a secret to share. When I was a child, I lived with my grandma. She allowed me to watch Unsolved Mysteries. Fast forward to 2008, my freshman year of college. A series of armed robberies on campus escalated into a serial rapist's reign of terror. That's when I created my first crime podcast. In January 2014, I picked up the podcast again from my college roommate who fell for an underage girl online, to the chilling story of a murdered nun in 1969 Baltimore, and in the throwaway series, I share my own journey of overcoming homelessness and how that experience led me to unmask a serial killer and identify three of his Jane Doe victims. This is Foul Play Crime Series, where the stories are real and the truth is waiting to be discovered.
Do you find yourself captivated by the inexplicable, entranced by enigmas, and tantalized by the unknown? We are Shane and Josh Waters, brothers who will weave you through tales that have mystified us for years. From haunted hotels to inexplicable disappearances,
our episodes offer you a panoramic view of the world's greatest mysteries, leaving no stone unturned, no clue unnoticed.
With a gripping narrative, we invite you to join us on a journey into realms of the unexplained.
We're unraveling the mysteries that have perplexed humanity for ages.
So, armchair detectives, curious minds, and seekers of the strange, it's time to put on your headphones and dim the lights.
Dive into the uncanny world of the Mystery Inc. podcast and prepare for a journey into the unknown that you'll never forget. And remember, some mysteries are better left unsolved, but not unexplored.
Thanks to our sponsors, and now we're back to the program.
When this was happening and you were reporting on it, at the time, did you think it would be solved?
Yes, I always thought it would be solved. And friends of mine at the time would joke that, you know, as each new piece of evidence would come forward, like, yes, the killer is going to be found. You know, so-and-so is a killer. No, so-and-so is a killer. I was always convinced that the killer would be found. And I still believe that eventually the killer will be identified. I have no doubt at all.
How's that information going to come to us? Do you think it's going to be through DNA or like found evidence or tips?
I think it'll be all of the above.
I just realized when I said that, I mentioned every single way it could be solved.
and that's it. Because we don't know. We don't know what we don't know. And that's the one thing that I've always, I learned early on as a reporter, that never assume anything because you are always going to be wrong. So it's look at everything. And I do believe at some point that the killer will be identified. Will he be alive? I don't know. I hope so. I hope he winds up going to trial. But at the very least, I think we all need to know who he is or was. And it's going to happen. It's going to happen.
Yes. And I did see that the Bristol County DA's office released a statement mentioning DNA testing, which I think they said they have completed it. So I don't know if you heard anything about where that's gone or anything, but that could definitely be a helpful avenue. I guess it's hard to know when all those crime scenes were processed before DNA was really a thing, how well that evidence was preserved.
Yeah. And, you know, that's the one thing. And we have to remember that this is an open murder investigation. It's a cold case, but it's an open murder investigation. So that the investigators do keep certain pieces of information quiet and to themselves. They do not comment on the DNA evidence, what is available, what is not available, what is usable or not. But back then, they were doing what was then state-of-the-art DNA testing. And that since then, they've also done tests on other things that were found at the scene, including, you know, fibers and things like that.
Well, that's good to hear.
Is your working relationship with law enforcement easier to navigate now that you're not the court reporter or the crime reporter? As you were writing the book, did you communicate pretty well with law enforcement?
Yes. Yes. As I was writing the book, one of the upsides of revisiting the case years later is many of the investigators, the primary investigators, are now retired. So they felt much more comfortable talking about the case and talking about certain aspects of the case while still preserving the integrity of the investigation. So that's, and because I'm not a daily newspaper reporter any longer, there isn't that fear that somehow whatever they tell me is going to be, you know, online or in the newspaper the next day.
Yeah, that makes sense. And they probably see that after so many years have passed, that this is only for the benefit of the case. Like, at this point, some tip might come in because they read your book, and they have to see the benefit there.
Oh, yeah, of course. And they know that the more publicity the case gets, the better. And it will also perhaps make people feel much more comfortable with coming forward. Because in this case, it could be that the longer it is, perhaps the easier certain witnesses will find it easier to come forward. Witnesses back in 1988 may have been afraid, rightly or wrongly, to come forward. But over a period of time, you know, we're talking 30 plus years, people's lives change. So they may feel much more comfortable because they're out of that world and feel more comfortable in coming forward with evidence or testimony about who the killer is.
Well, that would be great.
And keep in mind that they need more than just someone saying, I think this is who the killer is, or I know who the killer is. They need something that will hold up in court.
Yeah, I mean, that version of circumstantial evidence, like, was pretty good earlier with Kenny. If you're looking for circumstantial evidence, there was a lot of it there regards to him. How has the rest of the community reacted to the book, like the locals and some of the families of the victims?
They've been very, very supportive and really wonderful, especially the families, because reliving 1988, 89, 90 for them has been very, very difficult, because we have to remember this is a story of real people. These are real lives. These are real families. This is real grief. And when I'm writing about them, I always have to keep that in mind, that they are this is going to touch them to the soul. And that's a responsibility that I have, to maybe try to ease their pain, but nothing will ever ease their pain or grief. Finding who the killer is might help, but they'll still be missing sisters and mothers and daughters.
And they've all been pretty willing to go out in the public. They've spoken with you, they've done interviews. So I feel like there's a sense of, I don't want to say urgency, because it has been so long since the crimes took place, but it feels like there's still a sense of they're still motivated. And do you get that sense that they're still motivated for this?
Yes. The families don't want this to be forgotten. These women cannot be forgotten. People cannot forget that there is a killer out there of 9, most likely 11 women. He's gotten away with it all of these years. This is not right. The victims, yes, they were addicted, but they didn't get a chance to recover. And there's no doubt in my mind that more than likely all of them would have gone into recovery and had very productive lives and been reunited with their families. And life would have been so much different for their children, for their siblings, for their parents. And someone took that away. They stole a future.
Yeah. And we talk about it all the time, the secondary victims and the ripple effect that these crimes have. And it's not just one person committing one crime. You just described what it potentially did to the entire community, because you took somebody out of a community that could have been a positive contributor to the community. It could have been a potential school teacher that changes the life of some young person, you know, and that person grows up to be, you know, an amazing author or something. You know, like, it's just the potential was taken with those 9 to 11 victims.
Yes. And the person who did it just kept on living. Went on with his life. It is just the hardest thing to imagine, that someone could be a killer in the community and is still walking the streets. Because I do think that the killer is from the community. It's not someone who happened to drive through. You know, there's some people who don't know Massachusetts, or don't know New Bedford, if they're from the Midwest or the West Coast. Oh, can it be a long distance trucker? Well, anyone who's driven on 195 knows that, you know, yes, there are some, you know, long distance truckers who come through there but it's try maneuvering a large rig through the streets of New Bedford. That's not going to happen. So it's not the same type of killer that they may be seeing in the Midwest or elsewhere in the country.
That's an excellent point.
And even some of the spots where the women were found, a truck would have been noticed. The state police would have noticed the truck. They patrol those roads, and even some of the highway ramps where the some of the victims were found. The secondary roads to get to that truck, to get onto the highway, it would be difficult for a truck to maneuver with ease.
And to not cause a scene, especially when they're not doing this like once a year. This was, again, once a month, sometimes twice a month, sometimes three times a month. Like, this was so regular, someone would have seen a semi stopping. You know.
Especially on Route 88 in Westport. For those people who aren't familiar with Westport, Westport, Massachusetts, Route 88 in Westport, that's the main road that goes into Horseneck Beach. And that is a secondary highway. You know, it's your typical New England roadway, 1 to 2 lanes heading to the beach. It's not, if you had a big rig there, it would be noticed. And someone in town would have called the police to say, "Wow, there's a truck over there, and you know, maybe better check it out."
Yeah, trucks make a lot of noise. You know, I suppose whoever put those bodies there likely had to have done it fast. You know, I guess there are no credible eyewitness sightings that really came into play, huh?
No, and that is in this case why time was on the side of the killer. Because by the time the bodies were found, people can't remember back 3 months, 4 months, 5 months. You know, when a body's found in July and it's believed that the body was probably left there in March, no one's going to remember, "Oh, I saw a car there on March 5th or, you know, April 10th. People wouldn't be in their radar. They would not be thinking about that. And if they did come back and say, "Oh, I saw a vehicle there and it was a white van or a white truck or, you know, a sedan," they're not able to give the specific date, the specific time. They don't have a plate number, and you don't know if it was the killer's vehicle.
Without spoiling anything, you said that during your first reporting on the crimes, you thought you knew everything. And then once you were writing the book, you found out some more elements to it. Without spoiling anything, what are some of these examples that you can point to that came to you and surprised you?
In many situations, there were cases during the grand jury investigation. At one point during the case, District Attorney Ron Pina at the time convened a special grand jury. And a special grand jury was aimed at just hearing evidence in this case, hearing testimony in the case. He wanted to get all of the witnesses or potential witnesses, their testimony on the record. In case one, they died, and to just narrow it down. It was an investigative grand jury to force them to cooperate with law enforcement. And I was able to obtain some of those records. And when I was looking at the news stories that I wrote at that time and that others wrote at that time, we were thinking one thing was going on in the grand jury, but there was so much more going on. The depth of the investigation was really amazing. And they did bring up many, many more suspects in the case before the grand jury. They did explore a variety of avenues, things that the public didn't realize at the time. And because it was secret, grand juries are secret, people wouldn't have known it because it wasn't a public record. And for good reason. You don't want to malign someone and have them labeled as a potential killer when they just happen to know someone who was a victim or knows another suspect. I was really amazed at some of the additional information that the grand jury had.
Well, incredible job with this book. We invite all of our listeners to check it out, the Audible version or the actual reading version. And please, before we wrap up, please tell us about your new book, The Ghost.
It just came out in June. It's called The Ghost, The Murder of Police Chief Greg Adams and the Hunt for His Killer. It is about the murder of Greg Adams in 1980. He was the chief in Saxonburg, Pennsylvania. That's a very small community. So it's like a storybook town in Pennsylvania. The killer was a man named Donald Webb. He was from, at that time, from New Bedford. He was a small-time hoodlum. He was down in Pennsylvania with some other people. He was believed to be down there with some other people, scouting out some jewelry stores and other places to rob. The group that he worked with were called by law enforcement the Fall River Gang, and they would go up and down the East Coast, pulling jobs at burglarizing some jewelry stores, homes, restaurants, wherever there was large amounts of cash. And he was driving through Saxonburg. Police chief stopped him. A fight ensued, and the chief was killed, and he took off, and he remained a fugitive for decades. He was on the FBI's most wanted list and was hunted by the FBI for a long period of time until he was eventually found in 2017 by the same people who had hunted Whitey Bulger.
Wow. This sounds great. I can't wait to check out this book.
Yeah, come back on any time to talk about that book, and I will I'll let you know how much house cleaning I got done while I do the Audible version of this one.
Yeah, but I will not tell you how it ends, because it is a remarkable ending, and it will surprise you.
Amazing. Well,
you know how to do those big market teases.
This story just grabbed me from the start, because I was, again, working in New Bedford when I started down there about 5 years after the murder, and people were talking about more of the killer's stepson, who had been a New Bedford cop, than the killer. And I had always assumed that he had been caught or he was dead. Didn't know that he was still out there.
Wow. Okay.
Can't wait to check that out. Thank you so much for your time and joining us here on the show.
All right. Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.